Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the latest, and this is now the 11th edition of the Ukraine-Russia War Talk podcast. I'm your co-host, Professor Phillips O'Brien of the University of St. Andrews, and I'm joined by my co-host, who is...
Mykola Bilyskov, out of Comeback Alive and National Institute for Strategic Studies in Kyiv.
We're now quite well established as we're on to our 11th podcast, and we'd like to thank everybody who's listening because we're getting more and more listens, and that's really great to realize this podcast is reaching a lot of people. For those of you who are new to us, this will be free. There are no commercials. You'll never be charged for a subscription. But if you want to support the work, we ask you to consider a donation to the Ukrainian charity Comeback Alive, which Mykola works with and which does extraordinary service to try and help Ukrainian forces in the field and the Ukrainian population. Mykola, is there anything in particular you want to talk about in terms of Comeback Alive this week?
Well, recently we completed a major shipment of weaponry because in self-defense you need weaponry. So we recently managed to provide 382-millimeter mortars to territorial defense forces. We did it in cooperation with Oko Fuel Network Station, one of the biggest ones. So they accumulated money, we procured and provided equipment. We are very proud that we not only theoretically help territorial defense forces to evolve, but we also provided as much armament as possible. So right here, right now, we already provided them 120-millimeter mortars, and now we provided them 82-millimeter mortars, and it would also be grenade launchers. That might sound strange for people outside of Ukraine, but yes, we're a charity that has a license to procure weaponry. And for self-defense, you need weaponry and there is no other option. And that's what we do.
We're going to start with sort of the European North American context of the war, because there have been a lot of developments in the last 2 weeks since our last podcast. Sweden has joined NATO, so that NATO is now, in a sense, almost all of Europe as a defensive alliance. Of course, Ukraine is one country that really wants to join NATO, but has not yet been admitted to the alliance. So NATO continues to grow and strengthen as it has during the war. But there's also been an issue, and I think led partly now by President Macron of France, where the Europeans are not, I'm saying move away from NATO, but they're thinking about how they might have to help Ukraine on their own without the United States. So it's been a very interesting 2 weeks. On one hand, the confirmation that NATO is growing and strong. And yet, on the other hand, within a European discourse, a bit of an understanding that the United States might not be reliable as an ally going forward. There has been no movement on getting aid through Congress, that Speaker Johnson makes occasional nice words, but no vote has been scheduled. I think that's important. People write and they say, oh, well, Johnson said he will have a vote. Well, until there is a vote, I think we need to hold our horses and not jump to conclusions that there will be a vote. This could just be a delaying tactic. As of now, no U.S. aid has been approved by Congress, and that's the reality of where it stands. And that seems to have led a real, I don't want to say profound shift, but a significant shift in some European minds that really now they're going to have to help Ukraine on their own. And by the way, if the United States does stop aid to Ukraine, that really Europe as a whole now must look to the continent's own security. And that almost makes a Ukrainian victory more imperative, certainly makes a Russian defeat more important. But Mykola, I'll first turn to you to talk about the Ukrainian perspective of these international or Western developments that you see. You do see NATO growing. On the other hand, you do see this European movement in another way. From the Ukrainian perspective, what is actually standing out and what do you think is important?
Joining NATO is our ultimate goal right here, right now. And, well, there is nothing that would make us change a major course, major direction. For sure, we need to be prepared for any contingency, and there might be a contingency, but right here, right now, NATO membership is our end goal, and the fact that Sweden finally managed to join NATO, being a 32nd member of NATO since 75 years of NATO founding, it's a good sign that open-door policy is here to stay. And that's really important because one of the goals when Russia started big war against Ukraine was not only to stop NATO open door policy, but to make NATO withdraw to 1997 borders. So that's really important for Ukraine, the fact that Sweden is another member of NATO and open door policy is preserved. And by the way, I want to remind listeners that this week we celebrated another interesting anniversary. It was 25 years since Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary joined NATO. So it's quarter century, and despite all Russian insinuation, despite all Russian lies, distortion of information, and so on, enlargement of NATO to east to make Central and Eastern European countries safe for democracy, for economic development, it's a major success story, no matter what Russia say, because you can look at how things started, and right here, right now, you can visit Poland. It's a vibrant country, developing country. It's a bulwark of NATO, of democracy, of all other things. So that's really, really important things to keep in mind, because Russia is very, very good, unfortunately, at distorting narratives, perception, and so on. So that's with regards to the Sweden accession to NATO and quarter century anniversary of first Central and Eastern European countries joining NATO. With regards to Europeans finally awakening, that's, I would say, a lifeblood for Ukraine in terms of psychology, especially this Czech Republic initiative. Because it's less than 1 month since Czech Republic President Petr Pavel raised this idea during Munich Security Conference that they somehow found 800,000 artillery shells, 500,000 of 155 millimeter, and 300,000 shells of 122 millimeter Soviet caliber. And more countries, they made clear that they are ready to support this initiative. So usually it's about hundreds of millions of dollars. For sure, this initiative require a couple of billion of dollars, because one artillery shell of a NATO caliber, it's like $5,000-$6,000 a piece. So for sure, more of investment is needed, but this is a lifeblood for Ukraine in terms of psychology, in terms of actual ability to fight, because this 800,000 shells, it's about meeting minimum requirements for this year before European military industrial complex, first and foremost Rheinmetall, but also Nexter, Bayer, and Nammo start to produce the necessary minimum requirement of 155 millimeter shells for good defense, and then maybe for offense. That's why we really appreciate this kind of scenes, and that's about the light in the tunnel, very important scene for Ukraine. With regards to Macron initiatives, well, for us, it's a good sign how people change their mind, change their perception. Because if we recall, Macron was the last leader of big European country who still tried to preserve some channel of communication with Putin, some illusions that, well, Russian interest should be taken into account while devising security architecture and so on. Unfortunately, Macron was fairly mocked, but mocked for all this kind of scenes even during May 2022. But right here, right now, it's 180% change of French position. It's really welcome. For sure, it should be done by a kind of coalition of willing if they want to place their troops. Well, we understand that now France or other countries that would join this ad hoc initiative, they are not going to fight for Ukraine, but at least they can bring training missions to Ukraine. They can ensure safety and security of specific urban areas, and it would be a sign for Putin that you can't move beyond certain points. So everything that is done by Europe, this Czech Republic initiative supported by numerous European countries, Macron statements, yes, in short terms, they prove to be divisive ones because there are different opinions. But in middle and long term, I'm sure that it would generate sufficient support, and it would finally bring in this or that capacity European Western boots on the ground, and it would be a sign for Putin that everything that he done is counterproductive, and sooner or later he should start negotiating earnest with the basis of accepting Ukrainian statehood and independence.
It's a fascinating thing and sort of partly a depressing thing from my point of view as well, that you were talking about how NATO is the Ukrainian desired endpoint. And NATO is in many ways in its most successful period in its history. It has now, through democratic expansion, states wanting to join it, states like Sweden and Finland, who had before had really long-term, you might say, neutralist positions, not wanting to take sides in alliance, but they decided, yes, NATO is absolutely key to their security. NATO has won. NATO has become really the guarantor of European security in a consensus way across the continent. And yet, at the same time that it's having this great success, US, confirmation of its importance, its very long-term future is being called into question by its most important member, the United States. And we have to say that's a reality. Trump, who might become the president in less than a year now, has called into question the very notion that he would ever fight for Europe. His former national security advisor, John Bolton, has said he believes that Trump would want to get out of NATO or not fight for NATO. So it's so frustrating and it's so odd because NATO has been an extraordinary vehicle of American interest. It's provided a great deal of security for the United States, a great support to American power. And yet at the same time, the United States seems to be at least partially willing to walk away from it. So on the one hand, yes, Ukraine needs to imagine, and I would believe its future would be within NATO going forward. But on the other hand, all of Europe has to imagine a future where the United States will not fight for it and start planning its security around that reality. So it's sort of hard to know what to make about it. I do think there are some very good signs that Europeans are waking up. I think the Czech initiative is fascinating. One of the most important elements of the Czech initiative is it now is accepted that for the time being, European funds can be spent, or some of the European funds outside of Europe, to get support for Ukraine. That there had been resistance in some areas to spend funds outside of Europe because it was thought, okay, these funds should go to help European defense industry. But Europe now simply doesn't make enough. It doesn't have the industry capable of helping Ukraine right now. Now they're trying to put into place these industrial capabilities and the shell building, but they don't have it. And things like the Czech initiative are showing that if push comes to shove, Europe is willing to actually spend money to provide support. So hopefully that will continue. And we'll talk later about the battlefield. Ukraine seems to be at least now having enough to hold the line, thankfully, that even with the greatly reduced ammunition capacity that they have, the Russians are still struggling to advance. Everything is in the mix, and it's quite extraordinary to see how this has happened. The last thing I wanted to ask you, Mykola, and from the Ukrainian point of view, it's amazing how time moves on in wars. Wars make things conceivable that people would have said just a little while ago, oh, that will never happen. Under no situation will that occur. And that is the idea, and I'm not saying it will happen because it's still a long shot, but it is now being discussed that European forces might find their way into Ukraine, primarily in a non-combat capacity, to help with training, maybe border security and the like. 4 weeks ago, no one was talking about this. This might have been considered science fiction. I think, it never was. But then Macron began the idea that saying this is not inconceivable. And he was supported by the Polish foreign minister, Radek Sikorski, and people saying, look, we have to have this on the table, not least for the benefits of strategic ambiguity to make the Russians worry. When Ukrainians hear about the notion of European combat forces appearing in Ukraine, even if not to fight on the front line, how is that viewed?
Well, for sure, most important thing is implementation. But even the idea been raised by French presidency and been supported by other countries that Europeans in this or that capacity might emerge on Ukrainian territory, it's a welcome scene. Because now it's not like Russia versus Ukraine fight, and that's it. With aid provided to Ukraine by Europe, by US, but it's more and more engagement out of European countries. It's precisely the opposite scenes Putin declared as the end goal of his special military operation. And again, the threat of hypothetical clash between Russian forces and some European forces might force Putin stop this eventuality, this possibility that if you move beyond certain points, then you might find some European forces and it would be a direct clash, might perform a good positive function. But primarily it's about training, because again, a lot of people, they need to be transferred out of Ukrainian territory to European countries. Like this French training program, more than 7,000 Ukrainian troops were trained, and a lot of funds were spent just to bring them to France and back to Ukraine. Now, if there would be a training mission by France in Ukraine, it means that more funds can be dedicated to training, equipment, and all other things instead of just spending them of transferring back and forth Ukrainian troops. So it's a welcome scene. Again, I just want to recall our last concluding part of the conversation that there are these two consensuses, one inside Ukraine, another outside Ukraine. And this morale among Ukrainians, this eagerness to fight further, it should be sustained. And all these scenes, positive scenes, readiness to risk bringing troops into Ukraine, this was at capacity, it's a welcome scene. It's for Ukrainians, it's a sign that Ukrainians are not alone. And it's not only mere rhetoric, and it's something that can be done in the near future. So that's really, really important in this critical period, most difficult period of the last 2 years of fighting.
It is interesting, you know, the need of signaling. And I mean, one of the things I think is very important about this shift is that saying to Putin, we're not playing your game by the Europeans. You know, it's not that you can bully us or that you can scare us through escalation worries. You know, that was one of the things that actually Macron said, you know, France is a nuclear power and France is not going to be bullied by Russia. Now, I thought that would be an interesting way to talk about some of the stories that have been published in the last 2 weeks. I know there's two we want to talk about. There's one that really, really bothered me. And I know there's another one you want to sort of discuss as well. The story that most bothered me was in the New York Times, and it was early in the week, and it was about a potential nuclear crisis. I'd even used the phrase trying to compare it to the Cuban Missile Crisis of the 1960s by saying that in October of 2021, the United States really believed, had some intelligence that they interpreted to mean the Russians were considering a nuclear strike. And this showed, you know, just how we could tip over into nuclear war and how serious it was. Now, I'll lay my cards on the table. I actually think this story was an attempt by people in Washington to justify the fact that they haven't armed Ukraine properly, even, and all their escalation worries have been overblown. Because what actually the story had to admit in the fine print once you went down is none of that intelligence meant there was going to be a nuclear strike. There was no evidence, you know, hard evidence of this. It was based on very bad, I would argue, analysis of sources. None of it went up very high in the Russian government. So actually, I would read that story and not say that there was almost a nuclear crisis. I would say this is another example of America doing very bad intelligence analysis and drawing the wrong conclusion. But really, what I think ultimately, it's an example of covering people's backs. And they've been talking about these escalation. Washington certainly has been overrun by escalation concerns. But time and time again, these red lines that the Russians lay out are crossed, and there never is an escalation. So these escalation worries have been in many ways ones that the U.S. government has talked itself into believing, in many ways being pushed by the Russian government, but when it refuses to accept the reality that they're not there. So that story to me encapsulated not that there was ever a nuclear threat, because there wasn't. And the story makes no credible case that there ever was a nuclear threat. But what it shows actually is that the U.S. government is far too much under the control of the Russians when it comes to their mental mindset, that the Russian nuclear threats have gotten into the thinking loop in Washington and play far too great a role, whereas they don't play a role now in Ukraine and the Baltics and the countries close to Russia, where you think they would be most concerned. So that story was one in particular that really bothered me in the last week. I know when you read that story, Mikola, what did you think?
Well, that's a terrible scene. Not the story in terms of piece of journalism, but it's a terrible story how easily Washington decision-making can be manipulated. So yeah. Russians, pretty sure they know that their communications are being monitored, because otherwise US won't know about all these original plans. So they know that they are monitored. They know that if they raise the issue of hypothetical movement of these tactical nuclear weapons warheads, it for sure would be heard, and then it would be factored in decision making. So as for me, it's basically a confirmation that for the sake of escalation management, ability to crush Russians more decisively, I mean, this grouping of forces that was originally engaged in aggression, big aggression against Ukraine, this opportunity was missed, and that's a good a good proof that in this balancing act, when on the one side you need to aid Ukraine self-defense, which is a noble cause, important cause, but at the same time preserve this nuclear taboo, Washington, Biden administration, it erred decisively on the side of cautiousness. And that's why opportunities were missed. And well, that's a terrible story, but it's a good example how decision making can be manipulated, knowing the weak points of your opponent. That's why, well, I agree with your assessment. What is the original goal of all these publications? Because this issue of whether or not Ukraine should have been aided more decisively, and what would have been end result if Ukraine is aided more decisively, it would be very hotly debated in future. It's already debated. It would be even more debated because, well, depending on this counterfactual, well, a lot of things depend in terms of credibility, legacy, and all other things. That's why, well, that's another proof for me that, unfortunately, Ukrainian chance to decisively defeat Russian grouping of forces, it was sacrificed for overcautiousness. Because, well, US, for sure, they communicated privately that you shouldn't do this kind of things. But publicly, it might have been done differently. I mean, they might have been openly communicated that if you dare to do this kind of scene, it would be political suicide for you. And that's why we call your bluff and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, you know, the timing of the article was also fascinating. I mean, the time that it mentioned, oh, this was October 2022. Now, you and I who have been following the war know why that's an important time, because the Russian army was in some of the worst shape it ever would be so far. It had suffered a lot of very high losses over the first few months of the war. The war was turning very much in Ukraine's favor. So this would have been the time that, had major aid been gotten to Ukraine, it could have done a huge amount of damage to a Russian army on the ropes. So the timing, again, of it seems to me very suspicious, that it's basically saying, look, we didn't arm Ukraine at the time when it could have done a huge amount of damage to the Russian army because there might have been nuclear war. Well, there wasn't nuclear war. There was never going to be nuclear war, and you should have armed Ukraine. It's something that I call, it's almost an example of Russian reflexive control over Washington thinking at times. Now, there was one other story in the last 2 weeks that I think is also worthy of note, and it was about the Ukrainian decision to withdraw from Avdiivka, brought along to a large degree because of shortage of ammunition being provided to Ukraine by the United States. Now, that story was one that I know you brought to my attention, Mykola, and it tried to make it sound like there was some disastrous Ukrainian withdrawal from Avdiivka. When you read that story, how did you react?
Well, as for me, it's an example that people mechanically apply zero thinking without taking into account all the conditions, because U.S. Military and political leadership, they never face this kind of dilemmas we face, because U.S. always fought in, like, in last 100 years in expeditionary warfare, always fought on foreign territories in Eurasia, and that's it. And they never face this kind of dilemma that, for sure, when military situation require withdrawal, you should do withdrawal to preserve forces. That's the thing, that's the point. But still, you are fighting on your own territory and sovereign territory. Avdiivka is Ukrainian city, and it's very difficult to leave this kind of cities. And that's why when people are saying, well, you should have left Avdiivka earlier, and that's it. As for me, it's been insensitive to all the difficulties we faced. And by the way, we need to remind people that for the first 3 months of the latest Russian attempts to advance, Ukrainian forces were quite successful in arresting Russian advances. So for October, November, December, before early January 2024, Ukrainian forces arrested Russian advance on the flanks. And Russians started to advance around Avdiivka only in January 2024, and it coincided with a full stop of USA. That's, for me, that's the most important thing, because, again, if it wasn't this acute shell hunger, I'm 100% sure that Ukraine would still be fighting somewhere around Avdiivka. And that's very important thing. People who say that, well, you should have withdrawn early and that's it to preserve forces, they forget to toll. And in general, that's been insensitive to difficult situation Ukrainian military leadership is faced, and it's usually really, really difficult to leave your sovereign territory, even when you need to preserve your troops, which was the case.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that I can just amplify in that. A lot of this comes from the fact that people judge how this war is going too much by the standards of what the US military might be able to accomplish. The US military operates in an entirely different world of fire ability and intelligence and the ability to stop an enemy and slow an enemy and logistical support. This war is not like that. Russia and Ukraine are not like the United States. And I think often particularly the American analytical community, therefore, can be very harsh on Ukraine because why didn't they do that perfectly? Why can't they do everything exactly the way I would want it to do, as if this war was a war game? And that's why they've always gotten it wrong. That, Ukraine had a tough decision. They were never going to withdraw from Avdiivka in some beautiful, perfect day with the roads open and pulling out troops with no problem. That's not how you pull out of a city in the middle of a war, in the middle of a dangerous campaign, unless maybe you're the United States who has full firepower. So I just think it was one of those criticisms that seems to me based on a pie in the sky view of how war operates. And war is messy and horrible, and it goes off the rails, and it's very difficult. Particularly with, you might say, peer level militaries like Russia and Ukraine, where one and they're struggling to exert control over the other. So these kinds of stories seem to me attempt to level criticism where I'm not sure criticism is the right thing. It's a situation of that is what war is like. So these were two stories that I think got us a little irritated in the last 2 weeks. Before we end up today, I think it would be worthwhile talking a little bit for the last few minutes about what's happening on the battlefield or in the war in general. We've been talking about stories and geopolitics. There were two things we wanted to mention in this last phase. One, just a few hours ago, there were reports of another Ukrainian attack on a Russian oil refinery, this time in Kaluga, which is about 50 miles to the southwest of Moscow. There does seem to be a growth in the Ukrainian ranged UAV campaign against Russian economic targets, particularly oil refineries. And that seems to be at least hitting the target more regularly. From your point of view, Mykola, is this something that's always been going on, or is there now a noticeable uptick in the kind of ranged UAV attacks that Ukraine is operating?
Well, since 2022 start of hostilities, we for sure targeted Russian refineries, but they were closer to Ukrainian Russian border. Now the scale and the range is bigger one, and I would say that what we've seen in the last couple of days, last week, it's the biggest scale of attack, because that was a first wave at the end of the January, the beginning of February. Now is a second scale, and it's pretty sure within the scenes we predicted at the end of the last year, the beginning of this year, what Ukrainian military strategy would be. And we predicted a lot of long-range strikes targeting the Russian war machine in general, because everything related to Russian ability to generate, sustain, and employ Russian grouping of forces, legitimate target. Now we're talking about power generation, because oil and gas, it's the basis of Russian economy. That's one of the scenes, how we bring war to Russia, how we level the field, because in the first year, especially, it was a very asymmetrical situation favoring Russia, when Russians were able to strike whatever target they want all over Ukraine, including oil refineries, but not also oil refineries. And Ukraine has very limited range, very limited capability. Right now, we are leveling field, and I'm pretty sure that the scale and sophistication of these attacks will increase. And first, we would create a lot of dilemmas for Russian military leadership in terms of what to do with limited stock of air defense assets. And Russia is a huge country, because in Ukraine, we face this challenge how to balance battlefield air defense and country air defense. But Russia would face this dilemma. It would be a couple of times more acute one. And in general, I think we would be at the point when we would be able to undermine this Russian war machine in general. And it's a good case of asymmetric warfare, of bringing war to Russia, doing everything in our power to undermine Russian war machine. And well, The only thing is the scale, and I'm pretty sure that we'll see a lot of more of these attacks, and the scale and sophistication will increase. So that's one of the most important developments of this year campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know to, you know, we thankfully the Ukrainians don't tell us they're stockpiling issues, but the Russians did release a picture. Some Russian sources took a picture of the Taganrog refinery attack, and there did seem to be a sort of pretty substantial long-range Ukrainian UAV used in that operation. So clearly, Ukraine has been putting some effort, as we've been talking about, into developing long-range strike capacity. And what's interesting is the attacks are getting through, so they're not getting shot down. And this capacity, hopefully, will only grow for Ukraine going forward. So I think that's a good sign that if Ukraine can do with long-range strike against oil what they've done, you might say, on the sea in the Black Sea, that shows a way forward for Ukraine in this war. Now, last subject before we end up, because we are reaching the end here, is what's going on in the battlefield. At least so far, I mean, there were people talking about Ukraine being forced back even further after Avdiivka, that you might see even significant Ukrainian withdrawals. I remember people saying about Robotyne. But actually, the battlefield seems, and I'm not trying to say this to be optimistic, I'm not, you know, that's still a horrible situation, but at least as of now, it seems relatively stable. And Ukraine is building a defensive line. Is that a fair summation in your mind, Mykola?
I would say that miraculously we are standing, despite a huge deficit of classic shells. So you can count. So for every single day, we have at best 1.5 thousand shells. So there is a number of directions. For every direction, we have at best maybe 200, 250 shells. For a frontage of tens of kilometers. So despite all this huge deficit, maybe thanks to the huge inflow of kamikaze UAVs based on the FPV technology, because in the last 2 months, I mean January, February, whooping 200,000 FPV drones was produced. And the only thing now is to have a proper amount of operators and frequencies. But despite all this kind of things, if you look at the situation on the ground, so first we stabilized the front line to the west of Avdiivka, to the west-northwest. So now fighting is ongoing on the line of Orlivka, Berdychi, Tonenke. And on other axes, situation is pretty the same. I mean, around Kupiansk, it's still Senkivka and Tabaivka. To near Liman, it's like Terniyampolivka. Near Bakhmut, it's still Bohdanivka, Ivanivska, and Klishivka. And still Robotyn assailant is standing, and still Krynky bridgehead is standing. That's a huge success given the deficit of weaponry we are currently refilling. Maybe a major boost for troop psychology is the fact that Europe is rising up to the occasion and accumulating proper amount of money and is ready to spend them on ammunition from the third countries. That's also a huge moral boost for Ukrainians. And right now, despite a huge Russian advantage in firepower, Russians are barely successful, and if we have a bit more of shells, I'm pretty sure that even around the Avdiivka situation would have been different. So right now, we are quite successful in an active defense, in treating Russians in proper attrition balance, and in general, in this kind of military strategy for this year campaign we discussed. So it goes pretty along the lines, the parameters we discussed. And in terms of minimum requirements for the this year campaign success, we are meeting them, because it's about defending territories we currently control and treating Russia as far as possible.
Yeah, I mean, the line's holding, and certainly if Europe can get those shells to Ukraine, there is a good chance that the line can continue to hold, but Ukraine is going to have to get ammunition. Well, there we are. Another wrap-up of the last 2 weeks. There's been a lot going on in the war. Ukraine is fighting and fighting back hard. We're going to continue with these podcasts, and we really appreciate all of our listeners. And all we can say again is if you'd like to support our work, we'd really love for you to go to Come Back and Live and make a donation. So as we head off, I am Professor Phillips O'Brien saying goodbye, and my co-host is
Mykola Beliskov of Come Back Alive. And again, if you want to support Come Back Alive, think about like subscribing on a monthly basis. So if you're ready to donate some fixed sum of money, that's also a kind of option. So you might use this opportunity.
Great. Yeah. Any way you can support them would be great by us. So take care, everyone, and we will be back in 2 weeks' time.